to Maya. So please engage me now in loving devotional service of your lotus feet. So that was a very nice explanation. I particularly like that bit about the Tathasta energy, that the position of the living beings is changeable. You can be in Maya, you can be a demon, but if you hear the chanting of the Maha Mantra, then if you just once accept the supremacy of the Lord, then you can completely change your whole life around. That's the purpose of chanting Hare Krishna. Yeah, and the meaning, of course, is that we're praying to Krishna and Radharani to engage us in their service because we don't want to be in Maya. Okay, so that's a little intro then. So we'll look at individual chanting, japa. Now let's see. What I'm going to start with here is a brief overview of the history of initiations in ISKCON, because of course the process of initiation is to give us a chance to become serious about chanting Hare Krishna. We can hear it casually, other people chanting, or we can come to the temple, we can join in with the kirtan. But japa, that is when you become very, you know, intent, when you declare your intent to become a devotee. And of course, initiation is the point at which, when you're serious enough, then you can accept the rules and regulations of spiritual life. You can accept formally the shelter and the guidance of a spiritual master or a pure devotee. And you commit yourself to being a devotee. So it's a very obviously significant event. Harinam Diksha. And then, of course, after that, Brahman initiation. So, if we look at Srila Prabhupada, when he went to the West there, because he had one disciple, Prabhupada had a disciple already before he went to the West. His name was Acharya Prabhaka. He became initiated, Prabhaka Misra, his name was. He was initiated around about 1955, when Prabhupada was living in Jhansi. And he was given the name Haridas. At that time, there was a group of medical students. They were all medical men. They were all living, actually, with Prabhupada. He had this property that he was renting. Some students were attracted. They were even staying with him. You know, they would listen to him lecture. And in the daytime, they would go off and do their medical studies. So this one man, he was a little serious, so Prabhupada initiated him. So at that time, of course, Prabhupada had formally left his family, taken Vanaprastha. There was no ceremony for that, but he just did it. And then, you know, he was doing his best to do his personal preaching work. But he told me that actually that man, he was not really serious. And the other ones, he said, I didn't initiate them because they weren't serious at all. So after that, then Prabhupada didn't initiate anybody until he came to the West. But we see that as soon as he arrived in New York and started his preaching, within just 2 months, he initiated his first batch of disciples, Western disciples. So Prabhupada inaugurated ISKCON in July of 1966 in New York formally. You know, he did the legal work, made it into a proper society. And by that time, he had a few young men that were coming around. They were hearing Bhagavad Gita class from him in the evenings. Some of them started to become a little serious. They were coming and chanting. And the first thing that Prabhupada did was he introduced them to, you know, chanting japa. So he had them go out. They bought wooden beads from a local store. They strung their own beads. And then Prabhupada instructed them how to chant. So he did that, you know, right from the very beginning. He didn't hesitate. And within 2 months, on Janmashtami, that year was September the 6th. So Prabhupada initiated a batch of these young men. as his disciples, he gave them spiritual names. He chanted on their beads. He performed the Jagya. Then he told them what it means to be initiated. It's very interesting. Prabhupada was very keen to get ISKCON off the ground. And so he was quite, although we see that he wasn't prepared to take the risk with those medical students in Jhansi, where you would have thought they would have been more qualified than a bunch of hippies, you know, malechas that were living in New York. But Prabhupada's mood was a little different. Of course, by the time he got to America, he knew he had limited time and he wanted to get something established, solid. So immediately he initiated these boys, and many of them didn't even know what initiation was. They had no clue what obligation there was, anything. There was no vows. Just afterwards, Prabhupada wrote out, you know, a few simple rules and regulations that was pinned on the board, and it said all initiated devotees now must observe these rules. So some of them didn't even know that, you know, they had to abstain from intoxicants or... I mean, they knew that the Swamiji didn't like that, but they didn't know that by taking initiation, they were making a formal commitment, you know, not to eat meat, fish and eggs, not to take intoxicants, not to have illicit sex, and not to gamble. That some of them discovered that afterwards. So Prabhupada was being a little liberal there, or daring, if you like. He was taking a chance, yeah, that something would stick. Some of them would take it seriously. And he had that full faith. We were talking last night how Prabhupada was successful because he had absolute faith in the holy names. That he knew that if people were chanting, that purification of the heart would take place. And then they would become serious. He knew also that some of them wouldn't. But he was prepared to take that risk. So, when we chant Hare Krishna, that means that literally we have Krishna dancing on our tongues. And through public kirtan, Krishna is available to everybody. But nevertheless, if we want to be really serious about chanting, then the process is to take initiation, because that's when you make your actual commitment. Casual chanting is always beneficial, but you make your real advancement when you make that formal commitment. You accept a standard, you observe the 10 offenses, etc., etc. We say there's no hard and fast rules in the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, but there are 10 offenses, nevertheless, that have to be avoided if you really want to get the complete effect. So Prabhupada started that then, and what does that involve? He was picking the candidates himself and approving them. He was awarding them their new spiritual names. He was chanting the first round on their beads. And he was doing the fire jagya. So the whole process attached to initiation was being done by Srila Prabhupada personally, because there was nobody else there to do it. Then we see that within a short period after that, then he started giving Brahman initiation as well. You know, Gayatri Mantra. So, again, there Prabhupada would chant the Gayatri Mantra. He would hold the new threads in his hand. He would chant his own Gayatri. And then he would personally put the Brahman thread on the candidate. And then he would recite to them, word for word, or repetitively, the Gayatri Mantra. So that was the system. He was doing that. So this is, you know, the sadhana of chanting. So then what happened? Krishna consciousness began to expand very rapidly. By early 1968, there were 5 temples in North America and about 50 or 60 initiated devotees, excuse me. But then from 1968 to 1971, a period of 4 years, at the end of 1971, there were 60 temples and about 600 initiated devotees. So within that 4-year period, the movement expanded 10 times its size. And not just in America, You know, it went to Europe, it went to Africa, went back to India, went to Asia, Japan, Australia, all over the world. So, you know, this kind of exponential development was taking place, and Srila Prabhupada had to cope with that. He had to figure out how to deal with that. Obviously, it was not possible for him to travel, you know, to every center. And then what to speak about from 71 onwards, again, the number of initiated disciples went up from about 600 to 5,000 by the time Prabhupada left us in 77. And the number of temples had almost doubled again, up to 108. So with that kind of, you know, increase in volume, then Prabhupada had to think about some more innovative means of coping with that. You know, it wasn't just a question of him sitting in one place and all the, you know, aspiring disciples would come to him and then, you know, he would see them and approve them and chant on everybody's beads and what have you. It was just not possible to do that anymore. So Prabhupada had to very quickly think about how to cope with all of that. And so what he did was he started to delegate the different aspects of the process of initiation. So he had a few Brahmana disciples by 1968. He had started to install deities around that same time. So the temples were getting some structure. Before that, it was kind of very casual. Somebody mentioned the other day that they thought that Mangalarati was not made a rule until about 1971. Because there were temples where deities had been installed by that time. And Prabhupada was pushing, you know, this what we call the morning program. He formulated that as he was going along. As more people were coming, he started to structure everything. He brought more aspects of sadhana into the lives of his disciples. And, you know, there were more rules and regulations to follow as people became a bit more qualified. So similarly then, Prabhupada had, you know, a storefront in New York in 66. He got another storefront in San Francisco in 67. In 68, around that time, New Vrindavan became the first country ashram, you know, out of the city, big land, and some, you know, plans there for developing like a village, if you like, a community. So that was a new development. And then gradually Prabhupada got bigger temples like Los Angeles and bought that big property. So in 69, of course, then he installed the first big deities in ISKCON, Radha Lundanishwara. So like that, ISKCON was growing and Prabhupada was being very innovative as it grew to cope with that. Brahmachari, Brahmacharini, and Grihastha ashrams started to become distinct. Yeah, it wasn't just, you know, a kind of happy family situation anymore from about 68 onwards. You know, it was becoming formalized. And then in around about 70, 71, then the fourth ashram, Sannyas, Prabhupada started, apart from Kirtananda in 67, but he started giving sannyas to a few of his leading disciples at that time. So Prabhupada then devised some systems to help him to cope with this very rapid expansion of ISKCON all around the world. So it was obvious not everybody could travel and see him, nor could he travel and see everybody else. Impossible. But people were joining in various places all around the world, and they wanted initiation. So Prabhupada then began to delegate these different responsibilities. He started something which was quite revolutionary. I don't know whether Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati ever did this. I haven't checked it out. But Prabhupada started giving initiations through the mail. Yeah, there was no personal contact. He started initiating people without ever seeing them. And the system that he set up to do that was that with his temple presidents, you know, they were like his leading people, then he told them that now you identify the candidates, you recommend them, and I'll accept that sight unseen. If you say that they're, you know, they're fit and qualified, then they can write me a letter requesting. That was still there, but the recommendation had to come from the local temple president. Then he also, of course, he had the temple presidents perform the fire jagyas. As soon as he got a few Brahmins, then he trained them up how to do the fire jagyas. Because the sannyasi technically is not supposed to touch fire and do the rituals, you know, of various kinds of pujas. But Prabhupada did it because he had to. But as soon as he was able, then he trained some of his men up to perform the jagyas. And similarly, probably I think maybe early on, even 67, he started traveling around and he began to travel with a secretary and a servant to assist him. So the secretary was also a delegate in that when people were coming, then all the different names had to be awarded to the new initiates. So Prabhupada had his secretary, or he had, sometimes he had a Sanskrit editor with him from 71, 72 onwards, Pradyumna Prabhu, and then he delegated them to find all the names, you know, for the different new candidates. So I remember when Prabhupada came to Sydney in 1972, he arrived there on April the 1st. I'd been in the movement 6 weeks at that time, and I was initiated. And there were some people that had been in the temple maybe a week, they were initiated. So Prabhupada was just trying to give a boost, get everything going. So practically, he just initiated everybody in the whole temple. And although he was personally there, you know, our names were given to either Pradyumna or Shyamasundar Prabhu. He was the secretary. And they picked out the different names corresponding, you know, the system was that it would correspond to what our legal names were. So my name, when I joined, my Kami name is Dennis Harrison. So everybody used to call me Harry, because my dad's name, actually, his legal name is Harry Harrison. So all the males in our family, we were all called Harry. So when I joined, I became back to Harry. And of course, naturally, I was hoping that I would get that as my initiated name as well. So when I got my name, I came forward and Prabhupada asked Shyamasundar, now what is his name? And Shyamasundar said, Harry Sori. And then he said, what is his, you know, his regular name? And said, Dennis Harrison. So from Harrison, I got Harry Sori. And, you know, there were other devotees there. Back to Philip became Partha. Back to Anne became Ambika. We all know that system. So that way then, the secretary was giving the names. And Prabhupada would... He was still at that point, because he was personally present, in 72, he did chant on our beads. There were about 16 or 17 of us, and one by one we came up. Prabhupada would chant very rapidly, you know, one round on the beads. And that chanting on the beads, actually, that it's not to sanctify the beads, it's to sanctify the chanting of the initiate. Yeah. I had that experience in 75, just after I joined Prabhupada's party. One of my friends had lost his beads, so he bought a new set, and then he asked me, can you take these into Prabhupada and ask him to chant on them and sanctify them? So I took them in, and then Prabhupada, he said, all right, but he said, actually, it's not necessary. He said, it's not the beads that are sanctified, it is the chanting of the person. So he said, even if you have to get new beads, you don't have to get them, you know, rechanted by your guru. So anyway, of course, there were some occasions when Prabhupada deviated from that system a little bit. There were one or two occasions I saw when the secretary gave a name and then Prabhupada wouldn't accept it, and he gave another name on the spot. My godbrother Bhagavad Ashraya Prabhu from Australia, he had joined late 74, and he went to Vrindavan. He was there at the temple opening. We had this big temple that was suddenly opened, and of course, you know, there were no devotees in Vrindavan at that time. The Vrindavan Yatra was very tiny. So Prabhupada told the GBCs that two persons from every zone, you know, two visiting devotees from every zone would had to be told to stay in Vrindavan and not go back from the festival. Yeah. So back to Richard, he'd only joined about 3 months before. He came to India for the first time, and then he was told, okay, you're not going back. Now you have to stay here. So he stayed and he became part of the first temporal, the yatra in the Vrindavan temple. So then later in the year, when Prabhupada came at Janmashtami, he was initiated. So when he came up, the secretary, Brahmananda, he gave one name, and then Prabhupada stopped and he shook his head. He said, no. And then he picked one out for himself, Bhagavatashraya. His name was Richard, but he got Bhagavatashraya. But on the whole, anyway, the general system was that you got a name that matched your legal name, and the secretary was doing that. So Prabhupada, you know, in this way was delegating, you know, the recommendation, choosing the name, performing the fire jagya. Up until this point, though, he was still chanting the first round on the beads. But just at the beginning then of 73, Prabhupada also changed that system, because people were sending in recommendations and he was getting, you know, more and more, maybe half a dozen, maybe 10 from one temple. And then he was chanting on the beads wherever he was. And then they would be packaged up and sent through the mail to the local temple president. But that also then started becoming a problem. So Prabhupada decided to also delegate that chanting of the first round on the beads as well. So let's see where this is. Now, that began just at the very beginning of 1973. So there's a letter then that Prabhupada sent to Ribati Nandan Swami. He was in Europe. And in that letter on January the 4th then, he says, just now I've received some more requests for giving first initiation from Dhananjaya. He was the temple president there in London at that time. And now I'm receiving weekly not less than 10 to 15 such requests from new students. So it's becoming very expensive to send so many sets of beads such a long distance. And it is also becoming a little bothersome for me as well. So now I think that you may be appointed by me to give first initiations to new disciples by chanting on their beads on my behalf. In America, Kirtananda Swami is going to do that. So the same day, he sent the same letter to Kirtananda. So now if there are two of you, that will give me great relief. Kirtananda will chant on the beads for the new devotees in America and Canada like that. And you can chant on the beads for the European continent new disciples. They shall, of course, still be considered as my disciples, not that they shall be your disciples. But you will be empowered by me to chant on their beads, and that will have the same effect as binding the master and the disciple as if I was personally chanting. So Prabhupada could do those things if he wanted. He could delegate responsibility like that. So they may continue to send me their letters of request along with the president's recommendation, and I shall give them the name and it will be entered by my secretary into our records. Only I will send my letter of reply to you, and you will purchase the beads there and chant on them and then send along with my letter to the new initiates. Is that all right? I shall continue to deal with the matter of second initiations. The sacred threads do not require so much postage to send by airmail. So with the second initiations there, again, another innovation that Prabhupada did, he was doing that through the mail as well. Now, because you're supposed to hear the Gayatri Mantra from the Guru through your right ear, you know, and you're supposed to sit there and he chants it and you repeat it. So what Prabhupada did was he used some modern technology to extend his ability to chant that mantra in the ears of his disciples. He made a recording, a tape recording. And then every temple in the world was sent a copy of that tape recording. And then when somebody was recommended for second initiation, Prabhupada, you know, they would have to write and be recommended. And Prabhupada would say, yes, I accept such and such as, you know, for second initiation. And then he would instruct the temple president, now, you perform the jagya, instruct them how to be clean, you know, and play the tape in their ear. So in that way, then Prabhupada was using his, it's like separated energy. Yeah, it was as good as Srila Prabhupada, but it's separated energy. So like that, Prabhupada was very, you know, revolutionary in a lot of different ways. So although he, as he says here, he continued to chant the Gayatri Mantra on the new threads, and they were sent through the mail. So just the month after Prabhupada had sent those letters out to Ribati Nandan and Kirtananda Swami, and that was January of 73, February, Prabhupada came to Australia, and I got my second initiation on that visit. And Prabhupada had Madhadvisa Swami, who was the GBC there in Australia, chant on the beads, even though he was personally there visiting the temple. There were some devotees that got a little upset. Yeah, they didn't want somebody else chanting on their beads. They wanted Prabhupada to chant on their beads. So Prabhupada said, all right, then I'll do that. So he did that just to keep them happy. But some of the devotees, you know, they accepted. Well, if Prabhupada said that's what, you know, it's okay. He's empowered Madhadvisa to do that. Then I, you know, they just accepted that. So that became, you know, the general standard. And then it became by 75, 76 that candidates that were writing from different countries, if there was any sannyasi that was in the local area, then Prabhupada would delegate them to chant on their beads. So that means then that all aspects of the process of initiation were delegated by 76, 77, giving the recommendation or picking out the candidate, doing the fire jagya, chanting on the beads, you know, because the playing of the tape, but that was handled by the temple presidents. So just one function remained that, you know, Prabhupada was still involved with, and that was the act of acceptance. Yeah, because that's the other side of it. That Prabhupada had to say, yes, I accept you as my disciple on such and such a recommendation. But then in 1977, even that one, well, at least at the beginning, it got suspended, and then that also got delegated. So what happened was that Prabhupada got very sick at the Mayapur Festival in 1977. And he never really recovered from that illness. It was building up. I was seeing over the previous months that he was getting very weak. He was suffering a lot of, you know, different kinds of disturbances. And when we had arrived in Mayapur in February of 77, I was giving Prabhupada his massage on the roof, and he just made this comment. He said, never in my life have I felt as weak as I do now. And then just very shortly after that, he got this very high fever. He was sick for about a week or so. He didn't eat, and you know, it was very, very serious. He seemed to recover a little bit. At the end of March, of course, around about the 22nd, he flew here to Bombay against all the odds, and he performed, or he presided over this last big pandal that we had. Modern civilization is a failure. The only hope is Krishna consciousness. Yeah, that was at the Cross Maidan. And Prabhupada presided over that, but he wasn't speaking every night because he was still very sick. And of course, we know that progressively he got sicker and sicker. So what happened was that in April, he stopped giving initiations. He suspended it. Now, he had done that, as far as I know, once before. He got very seriously ill in 1974 in Vrindavan. Shrutakirti, I think, was with him at that time. I think he got typhoid. Anyway, he was really, really sick. All the temples around the movement were told to hold 24-hour kirtan. And we did that for some days. And then when Prabhupada recovered, then, you know, we went back to our normal schedule. So I think at that time, Prabhupada just very briefly stopped giving initiations until he recuperated. And he mentioned afterwards, he said that one of the reasons why he got that illness was because some of the leading devotees were not following the principles properly. And therefore, he was getting the reactions from that. So anyway, 1977 then, when he got really sick, he stopped initiations. He didn't stop them. I mean, he suspended giving initiations or accepting new candidates. So of course, in May, Prabhupada had been in Rishikesh. He rushed back to Vrindavan. It seemed like he was just going to leave at any moment. He wrote his will on May the 23rd. He ordered all the GBCs to fly in to Vrindavan. And when they came there, he told them that if you have any questions, now you should ask. If there's anything that's not clear, you ask it now. So they formed a small committee on May the 28th. They went to Srila Prabhupada and they said, we have a few questions. So one of the questions that they asked was about how the process of initiation would take place after Prabhupada's disappearance. And because it's a well-known conversation, it's very clear what Prabhupada says there, that he will empower some of his disciples to give initiation. The people they initiate will be their disciples and his own grand disciples. So that was cleared up. It was very clear to us that after Prabhupada's disappearance, that was the specific question, then his disciples would take up the role of being gurus. Prabhupada said they'll become regular gurus. So that was clear. But then what happened was that after that, in June and then early July, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he was Prabhupada's secretary, he was getting, still getting letters from around the world, devotees wanting initiation. And it was kind of piling up, and he was puzzled what to do about that. So then he went to Srila Prabhupada and he told him the situation. And then Prabhupada thought, he said, so I will choose some of you, to act on my behalf. So on then July 9th, then a letter was sent out from Prabhupada by Tamal Krishna Maharaj, naming 11 leading disciples who Prabhupada said would now act on his behalf in accepting candidates for initiation. So this was the final aspect of the process of initiation. All the other stuff had been delegated, but the act of acceptance Prabhupada had retained. Now even that he was delegating to his disciples. And he told them, now, anybody that wants to be initiated, you just write to one of these 11 men and the whole thing. If they can accept the candidate or reject them as they like, and that's it. He said, but they'll still be my disciples. Yeah, they'll still be my disciples. So it's interesting how Prabhupada dealt with that. It indicates that in empowering them to accept those new candidates, that there was a responsibility of accepting their, the karma that goes with that. Prabhupada had said before that the guru accepts the karma of the new initiate at first initiation. He takes all their sinful reactions and he burns them up. Now, Prabhupada was sick, and then people were asking for initiation. He didn't want to overburden himself with any more sinful reactions. And I had seen sometimes, because in the, I think in the 8th canto, Prabhupada mentions there that sometimes the guru has to suffer disturbing dreams, bad dreams. as a result of accepting sinful people as his disciples. And I remember when we were in Hyderabad at the farm there in mid-December of 1976. I'd given Prabhupada his evening massage and then left him to take rest. And I'd just gone to the bathroom and I was walking back and I suddenly heard Prabhupada call out. And I stopped. I went, you know, what was that? But it was kind of a little bit incoherent. And then I listened very carefully and I understood Prabhupada's asleep. So he was just calling out in his sleep, and it made me think about that purport, that sometimes the guru has to accept, you know, have bad dreams because of the sinful reactions that he's accepting from his new disciples. So anyway, Prabhupada obviously didn't want to get that karmic effect anymore. So he delegated those 11 men. Now you do the whole thing. You accept the candidates. But there was a technicality there that Prabhupada wanted to observe. There was a certain etiquette, to be observed as long as he was still on the planet. So as we say, when he left the planet, it already said, now it will be regular, they'll be your disciples, my grand disciples. But there was a letter that Prabhupada had written to Tushtakrishna Swami in New Zealand on December the 2nd in 1975. And he says there, keep trained very rigidly, then you are a bona fide guru. And you can accept disciples on the same principle. This is 75. But as a matter of etiquette, it is the custom that during the lifetime of your spiritual master, you bring the prospective disciples to him. And in his absence or disappearance, then you can accept disciples without any limitation. This is the law of disciplic succession. I want to see my disciples become bona fide spiritual master and spread Krishna consciousness very widely, and that will make me and Krishna very happy. So, therefore, Prabhupada observed that etiquette. He wasn't willing to take on, all the heavy karmic reactions anymore, but as long as he was on the planet, then whoever got first initiation would be his disciples. But these men were delegated, in that last feature of in the process of initiation, acceptance. They became responsible for accepting and deciding who would become initiated. So Prabhupada distanced himself from the whole process, except that he was still there, and so they were still his disciples. So that way then we can see it was a natural system. Prabhupada all along, probably from about 68 onwards, or maybe even earlier, he had started to delegate different aspects of the responsibility of the process of initiation. And he just continued to do that in 1977. He just delegated that last feature. That's all. It's simple. No mystery. no concocted philosophies, new systems. new paramparas. No, the same old standard thing, that's all. It's just a natural process. Okay, so that's an overview then. You get initiated, you get your beads, you're sanctified. Your chanting is sanctified. That means that then Krishna formally accepts you in your approach to him, and he makes himself available through the spiritual master. That's the system. And you follow the sadhana. And then gradually you develop, you become purified. And then you get to a point also where you experience directly your relationship with Krishna. That's when you're on a very advanced platform. But of course, Prabhupada said that even though you're directly experiencing that relationship with Krishna, you never forget your spiritual master, who is the one who linked you back with Krishna and introduced you to Krishna. So he's always there. He's always, that relationship is always apparent, as well as your relationship directly with Krishna. A good example of that, actually, is in the seventh canto, in the prayers by Prahlad Maharaj. And he offers his prayers to Lord Nisringadev. So, you know, Lord Nisringadev, of course, appeared there specifically, you know, for the pleasure of his devotee, Prahlad Maharaj. He was a small boy. Now, as a small boy, he was inarticulate. But when Lord Nisringadev touched him on the head, he was able to speak very nicely and glorify him. And he was offered, you know, different benedictions. But the first thing that he said was, I just want to be able to serve my spiritual master, Narada Muni. He is the one whose mercy, by whose mercy, I am able to see you now. So that was his first reaction. He didn't forget his guru, even though he's seeing God right before him. But still he remembered, and he brought that to the forefront, that it's by the mercy of my guru that I can see you now and converse with you now. And that's the situation. So that's what it means then to take initiation. You get empowered. You get, your chanting is sanctified. It will bring you to that point. Well, you'll see God face to face. Yeah, you'll realize your relationship with Krishna. Okay, so that's an overview of chanting, japa. And now we'll look at some aspects of chanting. We'll do another 15 minutes, I think that'll be. So, one question that I sometimes get asked is, how many rounds did Srila Prabhupada chant? Yeah. And I can't honestly say that I know. I never asked him that question. It's one of those questions I always wish I had asked. But at the time, it didn't seem obvious. Afterwards, it did. But anyway, I never really asked him. But my my observation was that Prabhupada was chanting minimum 16 rounds every day. He was certainly chanting japa every day. And although I don't know the exact number, my impression was that he was chanting at least 16, and, you know, quite often more than that. And there's a couple of references that I've got for that. One of them is from Shruta Kirti Prabhu, who was, you know, Prabhupada's longest serving personal servant. He had over 2 years with Prabhupada. So he writes in his book, What is the Difficulty? He says, it's easy to understand that Prabhupada enjoyed chanting japa. He always stressed the importance of our chanting 16 rounds. He once told me that as a householder, he used a simple process for completing 16 rounds that we could also apply. When I was a householder, he said, I would chant 4 rounds before each meal and 4 rounds before retiring in the evening. So in this way, 16 rounds can be chanted without difficulty. So, you know, 3 meals a day. So if you chant 4 rounds before each meal, and then you've got balance 4 left at the end of the day, you chant that, and then you go and take rest. Bas, simple. And then Prabhupada laughed, and he said, if you don't take your prasadam until you've chanted your rounds, then you'll be sure to get them chanted. Because nobody misses prasadam. So if you make it a vow, all right, I won't eat until I've chanted my 4 rounds, then you'll always chant your rounds. So that's one recollection. Now there's one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, Nayananda Das Babaji. He left a few years back. He was very old. He used to live, I think, in Champahati in Mayapur there. So he was interviewed by one of my god sisters, Mula Prakriti Dasi. She went around interviewing a lot of different god brothers of Prabhupada's and people that knew Prabhupada before he came to the West. She has a book that those interviews are printed in. So this Nayananda Das Babaji, he recalls there, he says, as far as I understood, Sri Abhay Charanaravinda Prabhu, from the time when he first met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and especially later, he kept the highest standards. Even though he had not requested formal initiation, we saw that he chanted 64 rounds a day. This was during all the time that he was working full-time in his business. Whenever we met him, he was daily chanting and counting 1 lakh of names. When he got time off from work, he would immediately go and associate with the different devotees in the Gaudiya Mat, and he would go to Bagh Bazaar, or he would also go by train to Nabadweep and Mayapur. Because he's, he's looking back, I think about 60 years, he's recalling. So that differs a little bit, but at least his impression was that Prabhupada was chanting a lot of rounds every day. He thinks it was 64. But from what he's saying there, he says that when he had time off, he would go to Bagh Bazaar or he would go to Nabadweep. That indicates that he's thinking back to when Prabhupada was living in Calcutta. So Prabhupada didn't move back to Calcutta until the 40s. Yeah. So, and then, he was there about 10 years before he retired. So I think he's probably, thinking back then, and it's quite likely that when Prabhupada did curtail his business activities, they were dropping off, he was chanting a lot more. But anyway, I think that at least we can rely on what Shrutakirti says, that Prabhupada was chanting 16 rounds every day as a businessman, as a householder. And when I was with him, although I didn't ask him specifically how many rounds he was chanting, there was one occasion when he confirmed that he was chanting a fixed number. So this was June the 18th, 1976. Prabhupada was in Toronto. Some professors, Joseph O'Connell, Shiva Raman, and a couple of others, they'd come from the university. And they were talking in Prabhupada's room with him. The year before, of course, Prabhupada had just published 17 volumes of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, from that time on, the library party boys, they were touring all over, all the colleges and universities and libraries, and selling standing orders, full sets of Prabhupada's books. So it caused quite a sensation in the academic circles when Prabhupada published the entire Chaitanya Charitamrita within like about a year and a half. 17 volumes. Unbelievable. So one of the professors asked Prabhupada how long it had taken him to complete the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and he especially wondered when he had found the time to do his writing, because they could see that Prabhupada's traveling like crazy. He's managing, 100 temples all over the world. He's lecturing every day. He's, he's meeting people all the time throughout the day. Where does he get the time to write? Because anybody that writes, they know, how much hard work that is, how much concentration it takes just to be able to write a few volumes. So Prabhupada told him that it took a year and a half to complete the 17 volumes. And he explained his schedule. I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting, if there is any balance. And then I begin dictating. So that's a clear statement from Srila Prabhupada. I know one person that was previously on Prabhupada's personal party, who later on kind of fell in a bit of maya. He left, gave up his service, and he was running around telling everybody Prabhupada didn't chant 16 rounds. So this is the proof that Prabhupada did. Yeah, he was chanting, as he says, if there was any balance, I finished my rounds, then I dictate the Bhagavatam. So that means a fixed number. So whether it was 16 or 32 or... I presume it was 16 rounds, because that's the standard that Prabhupada insisted his disciples observe. And as the acharya and guru, there's no way that Prabhupada was going to do less than that himself. He was setting the example. So at least 16 rounds, if not more. It was interesting to see Prabhupada chanting. He would chant almost silently, just a murmur. And you could hear his beads clicking when he was chanting. Sometimes if you listen to some of the conversation tapes, you know, you can hear some very, in the background, if you listen really carefully, you can sometimes hear Prabhupada's beads clicking as he's, you know, having a conversation. So he would do that. Sometimes I saw him sitting there, he would speak, then when the other person was, you know, replying, you could hear his beads clicking. His lips would be moving, you know, almost imperceptibly. So as he was having a conversation, he would be chanting as well. So there's a couple of examples that Prabhupada gave where that's possible to do that. Because we always stress, you know, be very attentive in your chanting. Don't direct your attention anywhere else. You know, chant clearly. Enunciate the words. Prabhupada says that himself in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that you have to chant your japa loud enough for other people to hear. Yeah? And the lips must move, the jaw must move up and down. In other words, do it clearly. Yeah. So Prabhupada also gave the example that the ladies in the villages, when they go to the well, so they take all the pots. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4. Yeah, and they put them on their heads, and then they walk. And they go off to the well, they fill up the pots with water, and then they walk back. So as they're going along, they're talking, right? Women do that, they like to talk, right? And they talk, you know, gram kata, whatever it is. As they're walking along, they have the pots on their heads and they never spill a drop. Yeah, even if they're not holding them, they're walking along. But they keep their heads, you know, perfectly posed. The pots stay up there. They don't drop any water. And at the same time, they're talking. And then another example Prabhupada used is I don't know the name of them, but there's some dance group in South India. And their particular feature is that they dance with the water pot on their heads as they're dancing. Now, you know this ring that normally you see when the laborers, they're carrying bricks and stuff on their heads. They don't put that directly on their skulls. They have that ring. What is the name of that? There's like a cloth ring. And they sit that on their head and then they put whatever it is they're carrying on the ring. But these people, they practice, they have shaved heads, they put the pot directly on their heads, no ring. And they learn how to dance with the pots on their heads with water in it, and they don't spill anything, and they do all the dancing and whirling around. So it's possible with practice. So Prabhupada used those two examples that if you become really expert at chanting japa, then your mind is always on the holy name, and at the same time you can do other things. But that's only if you're really expert. It's not recommended. You know, sitting and chanting japa and, you know, reading the news on, you know, on the internet, or, you know, reading the daily newspaper or whatever. No, you should chant very attentively. But Prabhupada was expert, so sometimes he would, you know, chant japa as he was having conversations and things. Now, when I was with him, Prabhupada also, he got a new set of beads. He had his original set that he went, I don't know when he got those, maybe they were his initiation beads that he, you know, he took them to America. But then on May the 7th in 1976, Prabhupada was in Hawaii, so we'd been there for a month. And during the Guru Puja, there was one long-haired young man who came forward, and he presented Prabhupada with a huge set of tulsi beads. So he came forward, he offered them to Prabhupada, he put them down, you know, on the steps leading up to the Vyasasan. So as they were laying on the base of the Vyasasan, I saw Guru Kripa Maharaj glance first at the beads and then at me. And he had a possessive look in his eye. So he was looking, he saw these nice big tulsi beads there, and he was, you know, He knew I'm Prabhupada's servant, so I'm going to be the one that picks them up. So he was looking at the beads and then at me, and he had this kind of possessive look. So Prabhupada didn't say anything about them. He didn't even really look at them. We had the Guru Puja. He gave his class. After he stepped down from the Vyasasan, I gathered up. He went up to his room, and so I gathered up the beads, you know, along with Prabhupada's other paraphernalia. And I went up after him, and I took them into my room, which was next to Prabhupada's. So apparently this same devotee had given Prabhupada a similar set, you know, of hand-carved tulsi beads. He carved them himself. And Prabhupada, that was the year before he had given a set, and apparently Prabhupada just left them behind. So this occasion, Prabhupada called me in right after breakfast, and he said, "Where are those beads? Just bring them." So I brought them in, and I gave them to Prabhupada. He felt them, and he liked the feel of them. So he said, "All right, so now you string them properly," because they'd been threaded, but there were no knots between the beads. So he said, "Now you string them properly." And he said, "Have a bead bag made, and I shall use them." So that was very nice. So I happily spent the morning restringing and threading these beads. And Kusadasi, I asked her if she could make a bead bag, and she made this really giant-sized bead bag from this saffron-colored Thai silk that we had. So I was sitting in my room, and I was knotting these beads, and Guru Kripa Maharaj happened to walk in. So as soon as he saw me, what I was doing, he assumed, you know, that I was stringing them for myself. So as soon as he came in, he said, "They're mine." As if to dissuade me from any thoughts of keeping them for myself. I said, "No, they're not, Maharaj." I said, "They're Prabhupada's. He's going to use them." So Guru Kripa had speculated that Prabhupada would do the same thing that he'd done the year before and just leave them behind. And as the GBC, he had mentally laid his claim on them. So then, embarrassed, he immediately corrected himself for his offense. Hare Krishna. And he left the room. So anyway, those beads were used by Prabhupada regularly. There's some nice photos from when we visited Detroit the following month. And of course, we just got that big Fisher Mansion. It was Prabhupada's one and only stay in that place. And there's a canal at the back of the property. And our property backs right onto the canal. So in the afternoons, Prabhupada would go, and the devotees had made a seat for him on the canal side, on the water side. And Prabhupada would very happily sit there. And he had these big new japa beads, and he would chant away there in the afternoons. So those beads now, Prabhupada's original japa beads are in Vrindavan, in one of the cabinets there. And I think these new beads, the big ones, I think they're in Mayapur, but I'd have to check that. I haven't seen them for a long time, so I'm not quite sure where they are. So, okay. Now, oh, just when we got back to India, we arrived in Bombay on the evening of the 13th of August. Then on the 15th, Prabhupada was up on the roof of the old building there at Juhu. Rather than going down to the beach, he was, you know, up on the roof. And after about 25 or 30 minutes, Prabhupada decided to sit down for a while. Achyutananda Swami was there. He's kind of a very sharp guy. So he noticed that Prabhupada had this new set of japa beads with him, and he commented on it, and Prabhupada smiled. He said, "Yes, they are from Tulsi. It was made in Honolulu. In Honolulu, the Tulsi plants are very luxurious." So he was very happy about his having these new japa beads. Okay, so that's just a little glimpse of Prabhupada's japa. I'm going to finish at this point because it's 9:15. We got started late. I apologize for that. But tomorrow evening, we'll continue on. And hopefully we'll start on time. I was told actually that many of you can't get here until 7:30 or 8 o'clock. Is that a fact or not? Or can you all get here on time, 7:30? 8 o'clock is better, is it? All right, so then we'll start at 8 o'clock tomorrow evening, and we'll do one more session. The next day I have to go to Juhu for some meetings, and the next day after that I'm gone. So tomorrow will be the last session. I'll just remind everybody that, because we'll only just get, you know, just the first little bit of this seminar. There's actually about 14 hours, you know, to complete it. All of that is available on my website, lotusimprints.com. Or if you just type in harrysori.com, it'll take you to the same website. There's not just this seminar on chanting. There's many of the other seminars on health and cleanliness and those things. They're all available there on that website. So if you want to download those, then they're there. So anybody have any questions this evening? Yes, Prabhu. How did he get the latest? All right, he's asking, Prabhupada was traveling so much, how did everybody know, you know, where to send their letters? So the secretaries, that was one of their duties, that they would work out what Prabhupada's travel schedule was, and then they would send that out to all the temples, because sometimes Prabhupada would change his mind at the last minute and go somewhere else, and then, you know, the letters would get redirected. So sometimes, you know, he would receive letters that were a couple of months old because they'd been following him around to different temples. But generally, it was, you know, it was okay. People would, if you mail a letter out, it should only take about, you know, 4 to 7 days, say from America to India or whatever. So it was fairly efficient. Not much problem. Occasionally, not bad. Any other questions? Yes, Prabhu. You have to speak a little louder. Yeah. Well, why is it that although the guru sanctions the chanting of the new disciple is still lacking in his chanting? Is that what you're saying? The quality is not there. Because well, there's two philosophies. Yeah, there's the monkey and the cat. What is he doing? Don't play around. It was perfectly all right. Leave it. There's two philosophies. The monkey and the cat. You know those philosophies? The monkey carries the baby, right? But the baby's hanging on, actually. It's not like the monkey's always carrying the baby. She jumps around and the little baby has to hang on. The cat carries the kittens, she carries the kitten doesn't do anything. Yeah, the cat just picks it up in her mouth and she walks around and carries the kittens. So the question is, or at least the philosophical side to that, is whether by the works of man he can ascend to the spiritual platform, or whether it's simply by the grace of God, regardless of what man does, that he can ascend to the spiritual platform. This became a huge philosophical debate, I think, in the Ramanuja Sampradaya some hundreds of years ago. Some were, you know, saying, no, it's not just by your own works you can't get to God, it's just by his mercy. And others were saying, no, if you don't do the right work, then you can't get the mercy of God. and they actually split. Their Sampradaya actually had a major split in it, and they're still split to this day because of that. You know, is it coming down or is it going up? That's the idea. Now, our philosophy is different. What we say is it's the man in the well. Yeah, so you're in the well, you're calling out, somebody comes, he drops a rope. You have to grab hold of the rope and he has to pull you out. So it's a combination. Yeah, it's not just the cat doing all the work or the baby monkey doing all the work. It's a combination. The guy's in the well, somebody comes, throws him a rope, he has to hold on, and the other guy has to pull him out. So when you get initiated, it's not a one-way street, that just because the guru has sanctioned your chanting, yeah, that now everything is done for you and you're automatically perfect. What does initiate mean? What does the word initiate mean? Beginning. That's right. He's opening the door for you, but you've got to step through it. So guru gives us access to Krishna. You can't get Krishna without the blessings of the guru. But you have to do the work as well. He's not going to do all the work for you. Yeah. So it's a combination. So when we come to Krishna consciousness, we're contaminated in so many ways. We have so many mental problems and misconceptions. So, you know, at initiation, we agree, we surrender. But that doesn't mean end of story. Prabhupada sometimes, he would tell us that when he was giving initiation, that he would say, don't think, you know, now everything is done. He said, this is the beginning, not the end. So now you have to work. You have to prove, you have to show Krishna that you're serious about, you know, approaching him. So the guru gives you that opportunity, and that's the sanction. Yeah, people, they get purified from chanting the holy names casually. Anybody who hears the holy name is going to get the benefit from that. But when you get to the point where you really want to approach Krishna seriously, you can only do that by accepting a bona fide spiritual master and surrendering him to him. Yeah, so he's there as an intermediary. He'll give you that opportunity. He'll give you the sanction that, yes, now your service will be accepted by Krishna. That's his position. He's a representative. Yeah? Prabhupada used to give the example of the viceroy in the British Raj here in India. The viceroy was treated exactly as if he was the king himself, because he represents the king. Now, anybody insults the viceroy, then they're insulting the king. Same thing, not different. He's a different person, but they're one also. And everybody understands that, you know, the American embassy or any embassy. It's in India, but it's not India. It's America, right? Similarly, the Indian embassy in America is not America, it's India. It's a little bit of India. So in the same way, the guru is Krishna. There's no difference between guru and Krishna. It doesn't mean that he is Krishna literally in the sense of, you know, the quantum. But the quality is there. So the spiritual master then is a representative of Krishna. He's giving you sanction that when you chant now, it'll have the effect of purifying you to the point where you can associate with Krishna personally. That's the sanction. But you have to show that you're qualified to receive that. All right? Yeah. Apart from book distribution, is there any other service that Prabhupada emphasized? Everything. Oh, because there were some that Prabhupada prioritized, but it's not that, you know, anybody that's not doing book distribution is somehow or another, you know, less getting less benefit. Even if you're just washing the pots, you can go back to Godhead. But book distribution was especially emphasized as being a very rapid means of making advancement, because it not only purifies you, but it purifies everybody else that you come in contact with. It spreads the movement. So those who are preaching Krishna consciousness, they naturally get Krishna's mercy a lot quicker than somebody that's just, you know, concentrating on their own advancement. So it's you know, there's another example of the Bhajanandis and the Gaustiyanandis. The Bhajanandi, you know, he's making his progress, he's chanting, you know, he's pleasing Krishna in so many ways, but it's all centered around his own purification. But a Gaustiyanandi is out taking risks. It is a risk to go out and preach. Yeah? But because he takes that risk, Prabhupada said, Lord Chaitanya will give you special mercy. So, you know, Krishna is merciful, more merciful, and most merciful. If you distribute books, you get the most merciful. If you're doing something else, you know, which is just involving yourself, not necessarily anybody else, that's also you're getting the mercy. But it's a question of degree. So Prabhupada emphasized that this movement is a preaching movement. That is Lord Chaitanya. There was one time, it's a long story which I won't narrate, but we were in Vrindavan in 1976. One of Prabhupada's disciples left him. He wrote a letter basically criticizing Srila Prabhupada and ISKCON. And this man had been associating with these different Babajis in Vrindavan. And he was criticizing the ISKCON devotees only chant 16 rounds. They can't go back to Godhead in this lifetime. You can only go back to Godhead if you chant 64 rounds a day. And in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, Lord Chaitanya says, unless you chant 1 lakh of names every day, you cannot be one of his associates. So this fellow had gotten influenced by these Babajis in Govardhan and Radhakund. And he had heard this, and so now he decided that Prabhupada and his disciples weren't going back to Godhead because they only chanted 16 rounds. Yeah, and this was contradictory to what was in Shastra. Yeah, he actually wrote that to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada's reply to that was that he said, you take all the Babajis, Sadhus, Mahatmas in the whole Vrindavan area and put them together, you'll see they have not advanced Lord Chaitanya's movement 1 inch. Now, what does that mean? It means that they're claiming, oh, we're sitting down, we're chanting our 64 rounds. We are close associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, these ISKCON people, they're only chanting 16 rounds. They're not associates. Yeah? But Prabhupada's reply is, who is a real associate of Lord Chaitanya? It's those who are actually doing the work that Lord Chaitanya wanted to be done, which is the spreading of this movement all over the world. Prachivichaya Chajato Nagaradi Gram. Sabracha Prachahoi Bhai Monam. If he didn't want his name to go all over the world, then oh fine, just sit there in Vrindavan under a tree and chant your 64 rounds. Yeah? But don't criticize those who are actually fulfilling that prediction of Lord Chaitanya. They are the real associates of Lord Chaitanya. Yeah. So preaching is very important, and the most important aspect of preaching is distribution of Prabhupada's books. There's no question of that. Prabhupada emphasized that again and again. Yeah. Brihat Mridanga. Yeah. A regular Mridanga can be heard for one city block, but the books can go all over the world, and you know, they will transform people's lives. There's no doubt about that. So you know, there's priorities. Everything we do is purifying. Every service is valuable. It's not that we should think, you know, because I'm selling books, I'm better than, you know, the devotee that stays and cleans the floors at the temple. Yeah, that's also another feature of Maya. But at the same time, relatively, if we can speak about relativities on the absolute platform, comparatively, there are some services which are emphasized more. Just like in Vrindavan. It's not that the gopis are better than Sridham, you know, and the cowherd boys. Or, you know, they're better than Mother Jasoda. But still, by comparison, you know, there are differences in the way that they worship Krishna. And so we have these different rasas, and they're graded. And the highest rasa, you know, is Madhuryabhav. That doesn't mean that it's better, or that the, you know, the devotees that are in Shantaras or Dasyaras or Vatsalyaras, you know, it doesn't mean that they're less. That's a mistake to think like that. So one may be doing book distribution. That's the highest kind of preaching work. But it doesn't mean that those that are not doing that, say the pujaris that are looking after the deities, are less. They're not. All right? Okay. All right, we're going to finish. Suman, all right, you deserve a question. I want to say this man, he had rendered me tremendous service by building my website and getting it all up and running. So I'm very happy with him. All right, ask your question. Say that last bit again. Yes. When people are complaining, you know you're too loud. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. You can't walk around doing that. Yeah. If everybody leaves the room, you know you're chanting too loud. You just chant just loud enough so that people, you know you're chanting. That's all. I did that one time. I was a new devotee. I was a bit of a fanatic, and I remember one time we were in Melbourne, and I discovered that if I chanted really loudly, you know, then my mind would become filled with the mantra and I wouldn't think of anything else. So I was on the front porch because we had a house at that time that we were renting. It was like a row of houses. So we were one in the row. So we had neighbors on, you know, both sides, very close. And I decided to chant my japa on the front veranda as loudly as I could. So I was yelling it out at the top of my voice for about an hour, and all the neighbors were flipping out, and all the devotees were, what is he doing that for? You know, has he gone mad? Or so I only did it one day, and then it was, you know. So, yeah, just loud enough, just so that others know that you're chanting. That's the point. And so that you can hear it, too. And then that engages your ears. Yeah, otherwise, if you just chanting. I know that there's some devotee that I knew in Vrindavan. He again, he became infected with these Babaji's. He got their, adopted their philosophy. One of their things, some of the Babaji's there, they say that you're not supposed to chant a Hare Krishna mantra out loud. And they criticize, you know, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur especially, and anybody coming in his line, because we sing the Hare Krishna mantra out loud. And they say, no, you know, Nitai Gaur Radhishyam, Japa Hare Krishna Hare Ram. You're only supposed to say the Hare Krishna mantra silently. So they don't even move their lips practically. They don't say it out loud, you know. But if you do that, the chances are your mind's going to wander everywhere. So Prabhupada was trying to emphasize you have to hear the mantra being chanted. So the best way to do that is to chant loudly enough so that other people can hear it, and then you're sure to hear it. Yeah? All right. Okay, we're going to finish there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.